Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is John Richards, who is a research support staff at the University of Wisconsin's Ice Cube Project at the South Pole. John, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. First question, though, is the principal investigator of this project, Francis Halzen, gave a talk on the 11th. Did anyone manage to see that in person or online? Excellent. Being a physics professor of long experience, his analysis of what a neutrino is a little bit more in depth than what I'll do. He's also good at summarizing it for people who have never heard of.
Do you raise neutrinos in cages?
Or yeah, for example, we have a very clear little box. The Ice Cube project that I'm part of is a large scale neutrino detector. So I guess to understand what a neutrino detector is, I have to tell you what a neutrino is. That's a really vague sentence there, a large scale detector looking for anomalies in the universe. That's because this is like pointing a telescope in the sky. We don't really know what we're looking for, and the people who look at this data look at it in a lot of different ways, and hopefully I'll get to tell you some of the things that we found so far. And quite often they're unrelated to why they said they were building this thing in the first place.
What truth?
So let's talk about that. Good question.
Exactly, big question.
It's a subatomic particle that back in the early 1900s was purely theoretical. We knew about electrons, protons, and neutrons. But there was a problem with that theory, and that was that when you were watching the decay, sometimes neutrons decay into protons and electrons. But while you were watching that decay, if you got lucky enough to catch in like a bubble chamber, what you'd find is that the electron and the proton, even though their mass kind of added up to the same the mass that the neutron originally had, their momentum was not necessarily even closely related. The neutron might be static in space, and the electron and proton might both go off in the same direction, and conservation of momentum says that can't be the whole story, because the whole energy of that must add up to the energy that was originally there. So somebody posited a new particle, which they called like a neutralino, which turned out to be too much of a mouthful, that was not being detected going off the other direction. And at that point, all they had was pure theory. They didn't have any idea of how that would be detectable, because it doesn't have a charge. The electron and the proton make up the a nice matching set of charges, and it also doesn't seem to have much, if any, mass, because to the best of detection, the electron and the proton added together also add up to the weight of a neutron. So we are looking for something with no mass and no charge, which means that it doesn't react with much of anything. So why would we look for them? Since we know they're created in nuclear reactions, like in the sun, like in a lot of the astrophysical events, supernova, just galaxies in general. If you look for them, you may find something interesting in astrophysics. And what is nice about them, even for our sun, when you look at, don't look at the sun, actually, I guess that's a bad thing to say. But if you were to look at an image of the sun, what you're really seeing is the outer surface of the sun, which is actually relatively cool. It's only like 50,000 degrees.
Oh.
So, yeah, whereas the inside, where the nuclear reactions are happening, it's millions of degrees. But because we're depending on light, we're only seeing the light that's being created by those reactions is immediately being absorbed by the other stuff going on. Neutrinos wouldn't. So a neutrino being created in the millions of degrees in the center are going to travel out mostly unhindered, to wherever it in the universe it ends up. And so we've said that they have no mass, no charge. Turns out that there is a chance of seeing them. It's a low probability. What ends up happening is anytime it passes through matter, there's a chance that it will hit the nucleus of an atom and actually generate a new reaction. And so what you're actually looking for is a neutrino hitting the nucleus of an atom and then creating a new particle. In our case, the one we're looking for is a muon. A muon is a very short-lived particle, but it does emit light. And so what we're looking for is the low probability collisions that create muons, which therefore create light. So what you need to be able to see is really faint flashes of light. You also need a big detector because these are so low probability. Like if you had a detector the size of a human being or as a human being, you've got neutrinos passing through you all the time. But only about once in every 10 years does one neutrino interact with your body. Even though I forget what the figure is, if you look at your thumbnail and you hold it up to the sun, there's millions of neutrinos passing through your thumbnail each second. They don't interact much. So the bigger detector you've got, the more stuff you're looking at, and the more likely you are to see this sort of neutrino interaction. The mass we use is, since we're called Ice Cube, it's a big cube of ice. Ice has a couple of advantages, the main one being that light passes through it. Neutrino interactions happen all the time within the core of the Earth, but again, the light that might be generated by that is immediately absorbed. Light that, if an interaction happens in our a block of ice, hopefully it'll pass through and we'll be able to see it at multiple places. So you need a big block of ice, but also the atmosphere has a lot of nuclear reactions going on all the time, cosmic rays. Basically, the type of flashes of light we're looking for are happening all the time within the atmosphere. So what you want to do when you're looking for a neutrino is start filtering some of that out. What people have done is bury detectors in mountains. What we do is we bury the detector under a mile of ice. So we ignore the first mile, let a lot of the noise of other reactions kind of filter out and deal with what to human beings is incredibly dark ice a mile down. If you want to build it big, you also need depth. So we've got a mile of free ice and then a mile of occupied ice. And the South Pole is about the only place that you can get that scale cube of ice. And as it turned out, this is lucky, the ice that we're dealing with is some of the most clear ice anywhere, even in labs. The pressures down there actually help force out any bubbles, that sort of thing. It actually compresses them to the point that they disappear. The air that would be there is just diffused within the ice to a point where it doesn't interact with the with light at all. So. The figure I heard Francis Halsen say, which I actually don't have here because I hadn't seen it, light normally travels through water about 3 meters, at least at the intensities we're talking about. Light travels through our detector between 100 and 300 meters at the same intensity. So, as it turns out...
How does the density of the ice down at a mile to 2 miles compare with the density of ice we would freeze in our...
And it's not dramatically different. The pressures involved are fairly high, but it as a solid, it doesn't.
It doesn't compress.
It doesn't compress too much for it.
Okay.
There's some odd effects, and actually, some people on this project I know have switched from physics to glaciology just because they found some cool things about the nature of the ice.
And they have a lot of time.
So this is what our detector looks like in a schematic. What we did was drill 86 holes in the ice. Inside each hole, drop 60 light detectors.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I guess we're probably not going to hand this around because it weighs about 80 pounds.
Oh, but, okay.
Down. I don't know where we're going to put this, but I just got to get it out and point at it. So the ice cube. A string of detectors is a string. This is a single detector. So you drill 1 2-mile deep hole in the ice. Then you hook up 60 of these, spaced about, I forget what it is, 10 meters apart. And then you drop them down into that hole.
All standing together.
Yep, so there's basically one cable there that would normally have a connector on it that hooks up to a bigger cable.
So let me grab that.
Okay, so that's our cable. So we got a 2-mile long cable like this with a couple of strings, sub cables coming out that hook each one of these hooks into. So this, I guess, we can hand wrap. If you look in the end of it, you can see that it's actually made up of multiple cables. So each one of those little cables hooks up to 4 of these optical modules. So there's actually about 16. There's a couple extra cables in there for some tanks on the surface. So what is this thing? So I guess the best comparison I've seen is this is a light bulb in reverse. Light bulbs, you put in electricity, you get out light. This thing looks for light. When light is received, it produces a tiny amount of electricity. And that little pulse of electricity gets sent to a computer on the back of this thing. And that computer basically describes it, compares with some neighboring ones on whether or not this is something big enough that more than one of these detectors has seen it. And if it is important enough, it sends a data signal up to the surface through the cable. This cable is also, of course, the power supply for this thing to keep it up and running. So the entire bottom half of this is that photoelectric tube, that electric eye. It's actually sensitive enough, so light's made up of photons. Theoretically, single photons can set this off. That's one reason you need an incredibly dark place. Photons are hitting us all the time. Your average beam of light's made up of a zillion of them.
How old is this technology?
Well, the predecessor to this was called Amanda, and that was theorized in the 80s and built in the 90s. The Amanda detector was really, it was meant to be a prototype. They knew at the time that it wasn't of a scale that Ice Cube would be, but they were trying to prove that the technology worked. Mm-hmm. So the Amanda detector built in the 90s was very similar to this. So they were using 8-inch photo tubes. This is a 10-inch, so theirs was more volleyball size, whereas this is more basketball sized. Mm-hmm. The idea of a photo tube, yeah, that one's been around for a huge amount of time. There's nothing really special about this other than the manufacturing standards are huge, because one of the things that emits photons is radiation, nuclear radiation. And your average glass, like everything else around, has a little bit of radioactivity to it. So if this glass was made out of your average glass material, what we'd be detecting is stuff in the glass without being able. So you need something that's unnaturally clear to allow stuff to pass through and not just pick up stuff locally from this thing.
Where are these optical modules made?
So most of them were actually made in Stoughton. The physical sciences lab, the Kaganza Research Campus, if you've ever driven down, there's it's just a little brown sign, and it doesn't it was originally built for it to hold a synchrotron, which
Aladdin.
Isn't...
Aladdin.
Yeah.
Which is being closed down, and they're dismantling it now.
Yeah, well, and but the people who... the engineering that went into some of those experiments was perfect for building these things. The biggest problem with building them was trying to keep the physicists from redesigning them every year. Because they came up with a very nice stable design, and then everybody always comes up with this, oh, well, you know, if you put in a little doodad that detects the angle at which this thing is sitting, you'd learn so much more. And luckily we had some good engineering folks on staff who basically said, keep it stable, keep it consistent, and yeah, that
so this is the Volkswagen theory of design, right in the general
Yeah, just make them all identical. And
what's done to protect those as they're lowered? Are there coverings around them that are removed as they're lowered?
Before we deploy them, they actually spend most of their time in a black plastic bag inside a light type box, because these things, when they're exposed to normal light, get energized and actually take a weeks to cool down. So like this one, if it was a working one, even if you put it in perfect darkness, for about the next 2 weeks would be saying, I saw some light, and would be useless for this thing. So the deployment method is basically unbag them and deploy them as quickly as possible.
And they don't get dirty going down or covered with ice or snow? Or
No. So what you've got...
Let's take about 5,000 of them per cubic mile.
So actually the total number, we've got 86 strings, 60 per, so it's 5,160 of these things, in the final detector. So the way we make the holes, the first 100 feet of stuff at the South Pole is compacted snow. So all you do to get through that is basically drop a weighted, heated pendulum sort of thing. But then you start hitting solid ice. And to go through the solid ice, what we've got is a hot water drill that basically pumps down hot water and then recirculates it back up and then heats it up again and pumps it back down. So what you end up with is these things are about 18 inches. You have to melt it a little bit wider because it's going to start refreezing as soon as you... So that's looking down one of the holes. And you actually can see the water layer. Right now you're looking at the top of one of the modules going down. Mm-hmm. Once it hits the water layer, you can, if you're shining a light down there, you can see it disappear below the surface and see the ripples of
it. Okay, so it is water then.
Yeah, from everywhere 100 feet and then below is just a huge column of water.
And that eventually freezes back up?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the tricks, is it actually starts to refreeze fairly quickly. And one of the things they learned with the Amanda detector is that bad things happen. If you don't do it smoothly, the thing they were using to drill got caught on the way back up. And at that point, there was nothing they could do. They could pump down more hot water, but it wouldn't actually free the cable, and it was starting to refreeze further back. Their only option was to cut off the end of the drill and call it a year. They didn't have the equipment to continue that year. So in the diagram of Ice Cube, you have this little X saying there's a head of a drill down here that's going to be there forever. So
emitting radiation.
Probably. But what we're lucky about is that it actually made it far enough out. It's not in the middle of our detector. It's actually above. But yeah.
I don't know how appropriate is the question, but does that ice originate in snow?
Yes. So after 100 feet, the weight of the previous snow is actually compacting to the point where it is forming solid blocks of ice.
So it's just a matter of how deep down.
Right. And
the layer of snow is.
And actually, that's one other reason people have turned into glaciologists is one thing we learned from this is some interesting facts about the nature of the ice, which there's dust layers from volcanic activity all the way through our detector. And you can make a very sharp correlation between that and time. So there are... Right, and so, yeah, I don't think I've got it. We proved that the exact timing of a major eruption that people theorized had happened, but yeah, we've got a nice dust layer to prove it, that around 7,500 years ago, there was an eruption that created an ash layer within our detector. Yeah.
Is climate change a threat to your readings with respect to the thickness of the ice?
Well, for us, no. The warmest it's ever been at the South Pole to date is 7 degrees Fahrenheit.
Like Middleton.
and the average temperature is more like 50 below. Even if there's dramatic global warming, this part of the continent doesn't have a really we'll be all in a lot more trouble before this starts to melt.
And you get the impression also that this was like not really by the ocean, more way in there.
Right, since we're exact at the South Pole, we're a good 1,000 miles away from the edges of Antarctica, where most of the melting.
So
would
maybe they wouldn't be melting off, or they wouldn't get it for several.
Okay, so it's more compared to us than your equipment.
Yeah, our equipment will be happily. Basically, the next time we plan to see this equipment is in 50,000 years. We're on a sliding glacier. In 50,000 years or so, it should start reaching the edge of Antarctica, and then we can recover it. But other than that, we won't see this stuff.
I'm glad you planned.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
I think it just answered my question.
Okay.
I was wondering if the ice is moving and you have shear within it that way.
But it's not, not
straight down anymore.
Well, and if we went all the way to the bottom, we'd have a problem because there you start getting shear of stuff that's sticking to the rocky layer.
Oh, yeah.
But we're far enough above the bottom that it seems we're just traveling like a train, really very uniform. Yeah, so we aren't going to start snapping any cables before our detector gets obsolete.
Okay.
Lifetime of the detector at this point is estimated to be 20 years. The major thing that's probably going to happen is someone will come up with a better idea in the next 20 years, and it won't be economic to still operate this detector. But the equipment looks like it'll last. We expected a 1% failure rate on these, and we beat that by quite a bit. I think we only have 20 optical modules that are no longer responding. We did have a problem with these connectors. There was a plastic connector here that you twist on by hand. It turns out when it got cold, they tend to crack, so we cracked a couple of those. And what ended up happening was you drop it into the water and they short out. But what ended up happening over time is when it refroze, they came back because the nice cold ice was no longer conductive. To the point that the ones that shorted out started responding again. So
doesn't the temperature rise at the south side as you go deeper?
Yeah, but it's still well below freezing for us. There is Antarctic lakes down there, but not in the region we are. And I forget what the total depth of the ice is there, but I think we're a good half mile off the rocky bottom. So that warming to the point of causing us trouble, we aren't that deep. I threw this up. Why would we do this at the South Pole? There are some disadvantages to it. Isolated. It's incredibly hard to get there. They say you have to pass some good medical tests to travel because you are sometimes, during the summer, you're probably a good 46 to 72 hours away from a hospital. In wintertime, the planes stop flying. You could be 9 months away from a hospital. Basically, somebody said minus 40 is a kind of a good temperature for rubber. Their guideline is once the regular temperatures reach minus 50, they stop flying airplanes. And that's because the planes themselves are okay with that until you shut them off. If they start to cool down, you may not get them started again. So they stop flying the planes at that point to keep them from collecting at the South Pole, sort of.
Why are there Air Force Base in Fairbanks, Alaska?
They need to point out that after 50,000 years, they would be at the edge of the water.
they don't like that answer, I don't think.
There are fire planes that need to be ready to fly.
For rush.
They didn't trust the heavens.
Yeah.
Sitting out.
Now, this may be a stupid question, but I'm one of those earthbound practical persons. Mm-hmm. So the usefulness of these things you're looking for are to detect anomalies in the... on the first slide, there was anomalies of the what?
Well, let's see. Now you got me asking...
I mean, what are the neutrinos for?
Excellent question. The answer that Francis Halsen gave at his talk I thought was pretty good. Every time we've looked at the sky with a new method, we found something new. Like when we looked at it with radio, we discovered pulsars. When we looked at it with X-ray, we did discover the background radiation of the Big Bang. We don't know what we're going to find. One of the goals is to make a map of the sky to see where energetic neutrinos are coming from and correlate that. And it takes a long time to do that. The reason this detector is meant to run for 20 years is we see a lot of light in our detector, but the vast majority, like 10 million to one, is generated by stuff that's happening in our atmosphere and below. So only 1 in 10 million of those are coming from outside our atmosphere. And so you have to throw away a lot of stuff. The simplest way for us to filter is to look for stuff that's coming up through the crust of the Earth, because the only thing that we know that can do that is a neutrino. And when you map those back out on the sky, right now what you get is just kind of a random scattering of about 2,000 dots, and you can't really see anything strongly. This is an exciting result, but the theory is over years you might start to get hot spots in the sky where unusual numbers of neutrinos are coming from, and then what you do is you try to figure out what's going on there.
So you named something a neutrino, but you don't really know what it is.
Well, we know what it is. We don't know where it comes from.
Do you know what it's good for?
No,
that's
but
what I want to know.
And that's the joy of pure research. I mean, semiconductors didn't
I'm
have.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah. So I don't feel bad. Totally out of it.
One thing that I think is missing from her questions. Mm-hmm. You're talking about direction of where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. I assume the probability is that there will be multiple light events from the same neutrino hitting through, and your detectors are able to see a line of those, if you will?
Yeah.
Is that what's...
Yeah, but then when you see that line, what does that refer to?
Yeah, then that gives you a direction. Is that what we're talking about here then? Or?
Yes. Let's see if I can get a good example. Okay, so this is an example of something passing through our detector. Each one of those little white dots is one of these optical modules. The color of it tells you when it arrived. So this thing's passing through near the speed of light, but it did arrive at that corner first and did, we can't, go ahead and loop that. And the size of the ball that is showing is how much light was detected by that that light detector. So what we do is we look for those flashes of light, and then that line is someone's guess at what path the original object was traveling.
Which then so points you know, to you know direction.
It goes straight.
And because of the 3D cube that it's going through, you get an idea of direction.
Right, and the
plus or minus a few degrees.
Right, actually, for the higher energy events, they've got less than a half degree of resolution, they think. It seems to be pretty consistent, that they can narrow down in the sky half a degree, which, again, in astronomy isn't real. The moon's width is half a degree, so that's basically the size of the dots we're looking at. But
wouldn't it be the Newtons that are making that line?
Yes.
Because you couldn't expect one neutrino to hit that many atoms on the way through.
Right. So what you're absolutely right. You aren't actually seeing a neutrino at this point. What you're seeing is another particle that hopefully was created by a neutrino interaction, and most likely a muon. Uh-huh.
And the muons are traveling in a straight line as well?
Yeah, and actually the other physicists have managed to prove that the path of the muon is very, very closely related to the original path of the neutrino. And actually, the more energetic the neutrino, the closer the match. And the neutrinos we're looking at are incredibly energetic compared to like the ones that are created in particle accelerators. I think Fermilab is generating 1 teravolt particles at this point, and the ones we're detecting are around 100 teravolts, so 100 times the power that the particle accelerators at Fermilab can generate. And
how long has the experiment or the observation been running? I mean, is there a tendency for the muons related to the neutrinos that you're detecting to be coming from a given direction?
Well, the most exciting result is actually something that was just in the last couple months, so I don't have a good example of it. The original design for this detector was just detecting upgoing muons, upgoing muons that were generated by upgoing neutrinos. So that was the cutoff. That was the interesting stuff. What somebody managed to do within the last 6 months is actually look at the data in a different way, which is look for events that start somewhere within the detector. So the flash of light originates from somewhere within our detector and goes out from there. The reason those are interesting is that since it's something that we didn't detect until it got to that point, it must be a neutrino. And actually, once they learned that there was the original theory said, yes, that might happen occasionally, maybe once in 10 years. As it turns out, over the last 2 years, we've detected 28 of those events. And of those 28, about 7 of them are in a very small circle towards the galactic center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Oh, cool.
So that's our first exciting result that says that, yeah, there is some neutrino producers that we're going to spot. But it was in a way that nobody... I have a bias on here. I'm the computer guy. My main job is storing the data for this stuff. And under the original design of this detector, they needed to store 60 terabytes of data, which at this point could sit on about 15 hard drives. But that would be throwing out everything except for the upgoing tracks. What they decided is that storage is cheap, relatively speaking. So they've increased the storage of this thing from 60 terabytes to about around 3,000 terabytes today. And it's growing by another 1,000 every year. And what that allows them to do is keep a lot more data and look at it in odd ways. And that's one reason they found this thing.
I hope that you're... creating difficulty for all the people who became glaciologists about, see what we found.
Well, what's nice is an NSF requirement. This is a National Science Foundation project. Our data has to be publicly accessible. We get first look at it, so that the people who are associated with the project get to produce the first papers. But this stuff has to be publicly accessible at some point. So, each one of these, you can't see unless you come up close, has a ring of LEDs on it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm not sure this has the flasher ring. Mm-hmm. You get the idea. Yeah, go ahead. So Most of the time when you create an experiment, you build it knowing what you're putting into it. But this, we didn't know the quality of the ice before we started, because nobody's done this before. So the way we calibrate is we send down LEDs on each one of these, and as a calibration, set off known flashes of light on these to see what the other ones pick up. And that's
how far away
it travels, and that's how that was very exciting.
I noticed your time is in nanoseconds on that.
Yeah. Well, and actually, where's this?
But those don't seem to be coming from below. They're all coming crossways.
Right, and it.
Oh yeah.
Okay. This is actually what the detector is detecting, but this is also not real time. The length of this movie is actually 10 milliseconds total. Let's do that again.
I counted up 6,000 nanoseconds as I was watching the thing to move through.
Yeah, and I don't think in this 10 millisecond you see any that are upgoing. We have a live display that shows just interesting events at random that are passing through our data analysis. And somebody estimated that you'd have to sit there for 2 years to see an upgoing one because of the odds of what we're keeping versus how likely an upgoing muon is.
You can't tell what flavor of the treatment started the thing.
We thought no, but that's the ones that are being generated within our detector actually. We can calculate the total energy of those. The ones that arrive from outside, we don't know how long that muon's been traveling. So we don't know how energetic the original neutrino was. But the events that are fully contained within the detector, you can then get a measurement of how much energy that neutrino was carrying, just because you've got a pretty good total sum of all the photons let out by that thing. And so actually there are people who are looking at it that way to try to so neutrinos come in three flavors that we know about, and what's they're odd in that they I couldn't tell you it's like electron
that's beautiful. I really like that.
And they apparently, neutrinos can cycle through them, through those different phases, but they carry different characteristics. And, yeah.
I have a question.
One of those things have one.
Yep, everyone has it on the top side so that it doesn't light up itself, but it can be seen by the other ones.
Now this is all, it's fascinating, and I'm sure it's very expensive. Who finances this kind of research? Where you don't really have a goal in mind, or you don't really know what you're looking for, is any private company financing it, or are we financing that with our taxes?
Their contributors, like Hamamatsu, is the manufacturer of the photoelectric.
Uh-huh.
They funded it in because they wanted to know what they could do.
That's a Japanese company.
That right. So the people who made the photo multiplier tube is a Japanese company,
uh-huh.
So they got to ask us to do things that nobody has ever done
uh-huh.
with their equipment. They didn't know what was possible uh-huh. because they don't have the same laboratory that we do with this
uh-huh.
thing. So
you do get some private finance.
Some, but the vast majority of it is National Science Foundation is probably about 50%. The majority of the rest of it is other universities. The IceCube Collaboration is headquartered here in Madison, but at this point is about 60 institutions, Germany, Japan, Europe, and to a lesser extent, South America.
He did show us the list at the lecture, so you can go to the Saturday's page to see it if you want to.
How much information has been published and peer reviewed?
About which aspects? I haven't kept track because
you publish a lot of little.
when there was when Ice Cube had installed, they only installed one string of detectors in the first year. There was actually a hardware problem with the winch, so that was not a good year. But they did end up with one string of detectors, and somebody wrote a paper off the data they were getting off that one string. Because they actually managed to spot a couple that were passed parallel enough to that string to be detectable for a good chunk of the string itself. It was low probability, but over the course of a year, two or three. And so they published based on that, just that piece.
How long ago?
So that was 2007.
I assume then that's led to one of the data analysis specialties is following single strings.
Well, that's one of the ways of filtering the data. Yeah. And since it turns out that it happens often enough to be interesting, yeah. Basically, we have one problem, which is that getting data from the South Pole to Madison is difficult. The South Pole... normally, communication these days is through geosynchronous orbit satellites, which means they're just below the horizon for us.
Ah, yes.
So the only way we have to reach the outside world is, there's two main ways. There's the primary one is from older satellites that have started to drift. So during the course of a day, they actually rise up enough above our horizon that we can get a couple of hours of connection through them, and then they disappear again. So you can only count on about 6 hours a day of satellite connectivity to the South Pole. There's also an Iridium array.
110 bots.
Yeah, actually, luckily, some of these were really set up for data ascending. The only problem we have with those is other people want to use those too. So we get like 15-minute chunks on some of the high-speed ones. But that means we collect at this point, a couple terabytes a day of data, but we only have an allocation to transmit 100 gigabytes, which is a 20th of the data we collect. So we store the rest on tape, and then someone in my group gets the job of playing those tapes back. At the when someone goes down at the end of the year, like me this year, they just pack up all the tapes that we received and then ship them north. But that means that there's a really, there's a lot of pressure to make that 100 gigabytes a day that we get over the satellite valuable. So basically there's a filter board. It's a group of people who go over everybody's proposal at how to filter the data and how much space they will need to get their kind of data and to fit it into the 100 gigabytes a day.
Is a consideration being given to launching an imperfectly geosynchronous satellite.
Yes, and actually, some of these are old enough. We really did have a problem 2 years ago because our primary one was the reason they start drifting is they start getting low on fuel, and one of ours was that we were using primarily for the big data transfer was totally out of fuel, so it was predicted to start entering the atmosphere within the next 18 months. Yes. And at that point, we're like, what are our options? But it's been floated, but nothing.
It hasn't been funded.
Yeah. let's see. I've got lots more slides, but this is at your at your convenience. I think most of what I threw in here was just a little bit about the life of the South Pole, what it's like to work down there, because that's...
You know, this is the U.S. Air Force flying. Mm-hmm. That's an enormously expensive sort of thing. That's why my questions about who finances what, you know... I don't have to go into detail. You know where my mind is going.
Right, well... So this is McMurdo, the main port for all Antarctic activity from the United States. And so that plane you saw before, that was one that flies from New Zealand to the ice shelf just off McMurdo. And so if you want to talk about activity at the South Pole, this is, the South Pole is just a tiny thing compared to this. The reason it's important is because it's the closest to the south, to most places in Antarctica that you can get a boat. So you can ship stuff by boat to this point and then distribute it around the rest of Antarctica by air. But
so that is a ship there in
yep.
the harbor we see?
Yep, it's a self-unloading one. It, so it holds like 977 containers. And the C-17, which is the biggest plane that we fly, holds 8 of those containers. So yeah, it's got over 100 flights.
But I mean, with containers of what?
Scientific equipment, food.
This ice cube project?
No. So the stuff arriving in McMurdo is going to go all over Antarctica for everybody's geologists, climatologists. Like I was hanging out with some people who are trying to chase down. They were launching weather balloons and having them circle it. The problem is bringing them back down in a place that you want. So somebody's job is to chase down the crashed equipment and bring it back. Actually, ideally, they get all the information they want before it crashes so no one has to go out there. But
and there's international cooperation in that delivery as well.
Yeah. Well, because even though we have a presence here, nobody owns Antarctica.
Right.
It's covered by an Antarctic treaty that basically says it can be only used for peaceful operations, nobody owns it, and everybody who has a presence down there has a right to inspect everybody else.
Oh. I'm wondering how long those ports are accessible.
Well, this one, so the South Pole closes between February and October. So that's 8 months out of the year. This closes maybe in late March and then opens up again in early October, end of September. So there's about 6 months where it's blocked in.
It looks suspiciously like a ski hill.
Off his light.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, if you turned 180 degrees, you'd find the Scott base, which is run by New Zealand. And it's their scientific base, and they actually do have a ski. In summertime, it's incredibly rocky. So you.
When you say closed, that means there's nobody there, or just skeleton crew?
Well, a skeleton crew. So for us at the South Pole, we have two people working for Ice Cube who are down there year round. They change every year. We have a rule that nobody can be there 2 years in a row. The total population for the South Pole Station in wintertime is this year 45. So people from other projects, but the majority of people are there maintaining the station, running the power plants, running the heating, electrical work, cooking. I mean, the first person you don't want to annoy at the South Pole is the cook. The second person is the director of the South Pole. But yeah, the most important is the cook.
Do you have a slide of the South Pole facility itself?
Oh, let's see here. Oh, just quick. So this was somebody's alternative way of getting fuel down to the South Pole. We fly it all, which is incredibly inefficient. But one of the alternatives was dragging it on sleds. This is 110 tons of fuel, but it took, 6 weeks to make a round trip to the South Pole.
And how much fuel did it take to
fly? Yeah, exactly. Less than flying it. The estimate for stuff that you fly, for the fuel we use at the South Pole, you have to figure for every gallon we get, 3 gallons of fuel were used to get it there.
Wow.
So you take our fuel price and multiply it by 4 for everything that you do.
Do they have a good estimate of how much fuel is used by Ice Cube?
Well, when we're in construction, it was basically 10,000 gallons per hole.
Wow.
10,000 gallons per hole.
Right, so yeah. 860,000 gallons total, which is
expensive.
Yes.
And then to operate it?
So operating the station at this point, operating ours is a fraction of the station. Our major draw at this point is electrical power. Operating the station fuel budget is around $6 to $9 million a year.
Well, they don't do all of it.
They don't use solar?
Well, in wintertime, there's 6 months of darkness. Yeah. And in summertime, people have tried it. Actually, one other thing that we're trying is wind power, but the sun, even when it's above the horizon, it's still at low angle. So let's see if I got a picture of our building.
So those things don't generate enough power themselves.
No, in fact, their power sinks.
No.
Okay, there we go. It's taken from the wrong side. We actually, our equipment building is that one down in the lower left-hand corner. That's the Ice Cube Lab. And somebody did put solar panels on one side of it, but it was a pure experiment and it never really went anywhere. Actually, they put it on there when it was being used as a living facility, before Ice Cube even existed.
What did you say that thing is we're looking at?
So the blue building over there.
Yeah.
So each of the surface, each of the strings has one of those cables that runs to our central counting house. So that sits in the exact center of the detector on the surface, and it's a two-story building where basically the whole top floor is one big computer room. So that's the central hallway. It's basically got three hallways, about 18 racks of equipment, and mostly tangles of those red. Actually, this is the improved version of the tangle. The predecessor Amanda was running on optical fiber, which was smaller but had less organization on how they ran it. So when they had to decommission Amanda, they basically had to use hedge trimmers, sort of thing. There was no way to uncable it.
Okay, so this looks like a 1930s switchboard.
Yeah.
Bad.
No,
does the building need to be heated?
Actually, it needs to be cooled. Because our computer equipment generates enough heat. I think we're at around 60 kilowatts of power for this building. So actually what we do is we mix in cold air from the outside. And the thermostat is basically something that adjusts
open
the vents.
Yeah,
opens and closes the dampers. And basically, we've had a couple of emergencies where something has triggered like a fire the air handling didn't know what it was doing anymore, and it shut off the outside air, and it took about 20 minutes before it reached 100 degrees in our server room. So yeah, we produce.
Everybody rush over there.
Yeah.
So they shook up the nice thing.
But yeah, the computer. We do have a workstation, but actually, if you look at the back wall, you find out that this room is actually part of the air handling. All the return air from the server room passes through this room before going back down to be recirculated. So you're just a cog in the machine when you're in there.
I know the structure is on stilts. Is that because of snowstorms that might fill up to the?
Well, there isn't much snow, new snow that falls, but there's drifting all the time, especially in wintertime. So things that are put on the surface, let's see if I've got a good picture of that. So that is this dome that was built in the 70s. It actually extends about another story and a half below what you can see here. And by the time, this was from my first trip back in 2007. By 2010, the snow had drifted to the point where it was starting to go in the hole at the top. And they decommissioned it at that point. So basically, any time you build, you put down an obstruction, snow starts to build up on one side or the other.
So hopefully it blows under.
Hopefully it blows under, and actually, this isn't a very good shot because you can't see it. This has about another story of empty space. This is the main South Pole Station. The leading edge there is the primary direction wind flows, and what they're trying to do is get kind of an airfoil effect of speeding up the air as it goes under to keep that underside clean, so that they can hopefully keep it clear of building up snow for a while. So that's the new station that I've never actually had to stay in the dome, but I've been lucky enough to stay in this three out of four of the trips, and that's that's a very nice facility. It's got a gym, a cafeteria, three wings of dorms, a greenhouse. And it's about 68 degrees in there all the time. year-round.
Greenhouse, what are you raising? Veggies?
Greens. Actually, let's see, do I have any picture of that? So right-hand side, it's not much bigger than what you see there. There's a couch lounge there for if you feel a need for humidity. You can go in there and actually experience humidity for a little while. But then beyond it, it's only about, an 8-foot by 20-foot room. And hydroponics, so they grow, one of the primary things is just lettuce and other greens, because those grow quickly and they're easy to harvest. They do a couple of cute little eggplants and strawberries and that sort of thing, but it's a lot of effort for little reward.
Do they use artificial light?
Pretty intense. But that, they actually cycle, they do a complete wipe of everything in there every once in a while, and then what you're looking at there is only about 6 weeks after a completely blank greenhouse. So it doesn't take them too long to get produced stuff.
In the portion of the photograph to the left, in the rafters, what is that object? Is that like a loudspeaker?
That's a projector, so facing back the other way.
Oh, okay.
So the TV in back is actually the informational scroll that tells you like what flights are flying in and out today and what the current temperature is and that sort of thing.
Are you cut off from world news while you're down there?
Yes, because of the satellite. Actually, well, world news, whatever. The important things are like the Super Bowl. There are signs like posted in the Super Bowl that posted near the Super Bowl that says, "If you tell me the score, I will kill you," because you can find out the score fairly easily through text messages going over a low bandwidth satellite. But if you actually want to see the game, you've got to wait for a videotape to arrive from McMurdo. So yeah, they're
disappointed.
It is an interesting. I only get a piece of it. I've only been down during summertime. The real isolation, of course, is in wintertime when the people who are there are the only people who are there. There's no rotation of crew. I've got some interesting stories from people who have done that. It takes a particular personality to do it and do it well.
Have they laid cable from McMurdo?
Well, there's been experiments with it, but that's an example of a crevasse that they found when they were doing the fuel drag.
No. From McMurdo to a mainland or to New Zealand.
Yeah.
McMurdo's
actually has access to the satellites. We don't, so they actually do get.
But there's his satellite communication and not cable.
Yeah, okay. I 90% sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So those are that's in a glacier.
Yeah, that's just on one of the areas that they were passing through on the. The the question I thought you were asking is, can we get run from McMurdo?
Is that moving ice?
So even at the South Pole, where did I put it? Too far back. Okay, so this is the pretty South Pole. Or at least it would be if it wasn't under Dave Pernick's arm over there. So this is the ceremonial South Pole with the nice red and white stripes with all the flags around it. That doesn't move. But then this is the geographic South Pole, and that moves 10 meters every year. So actually, this is from the 2011. And the picture I took today, this last trip, I thought about posting it, but it's a little hard to tell the difference. But I am standing 100 feet to my left there because the geographic South Pole, of course, stays in the same spot, and all of the rest of us are slowly sliding off to the sea.
So where is the magnetic pole?
It's a good distance, it's off closer to the Vostok station, I think.
And that's moving also.
Also, yeah. Not staying fixed on one particular spot. Okay. Oh, in case you can see it, the pictures in the lower left-hand corner are the things that people are very excited about. Those are examples of events that are totally contained within the detector that they didn't expect to find. And so, yeah, that's the one.
When you say they're totally contained within the detector, what causes them to occur?
Well, they're still, so that's a neutrino that's managed to pass, that most of the things we're detecting are from things that have happened outside the detector and then the remnants are passing through us. Mm-hmm. This is one where the interaction actually happened somewhere within the detector and all the light that's being generated by that interaction.
Okay, so the neutrino activates a muon within the detector.
Right, and you still don't see the neutrino, but you found that the neutrino nucleus interaction that produced the muon is right there within your detector. We thought that was incredibly low probability, but it turns out it's more likely than we thought. Mm. Anyway. Yeah?
So, I have a question. How heavy is the string of detectors put in the ground?
Let's see. The detector, I'm pretty sure the heaviest thing is that...
Are there any pounds of detectors in the cables pretty thick?
Yeah, well, and that if you can imagine a cable like that 2 miles long, that's the heaviest part. I think that comes in around 10,000 pounds, around 5 tons. Because I'm pretty sure that's the normal load on the winch for that that string.
Okay, I think I'm just kind of curious about this stuff.
There's an additional cable holding the sensors?
Yeah.
Spacing them?
Right. There's basically just it's actually a nylon strap that you hook up these the chain, one above and one below. Uh-huh. And the main cable actually just kind of bypasses this thing.
But yeah, the main cable is not carrying the weight of the sensors.
Actually, it is. Yeah, that cable is. There's not a the thing that we're tying this into is actually just fed out from the main cable.
Okay. But are they still surrounded by water?
They're ice. After about 2 weeks, it's solid ice. Though the process of freezing in is pretty. Francis called it a violent process. There's the pressures on these things since the ice is expanding as it goes.
Okay, so the ice itself supports the weight eventually.
Yeah, yeah, but it has the cable has to support the full weight in water though, so that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
You get the buoyancy though it's it sinks. I forget what the thickness. This is a bathysphere. It's I think 3/4 inch glass. But you're likely to hurt your foot, but not the thing by dropping it on your foot.
We'll forego that.
Yeah, no, I'd rather you didn't. I think I have to return this. But,
No, that's special glass.
Yeah.
I wish my daughter were here. She's downstairs. But she works, she's an artist, and she'd be very interested.
We should wind up.
Yeah.
Do you expect to go back to Antarctica anytime soon?
I have 4 kids and a wife, so
I'm an attorney. You haven't answered the question.
right, because it has not gotten old. I would do it again, but it is not. This time I was away from my family for 6 weeks, and for me that's not easy. Yeah. So I wouldn't want to do it every year. But yes, I'd like to go again.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.